Hey friends, thanks for tuning in. Today we're chatting with Dan Moraine. He is a senior editor at CalMatters and has been covering California politics and policy for over 40 years. We talk about how publishing has changed, look back at the most remarkable stories he has covered, and discuss what is at stake in the 2018 governor's race. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't be afraid to share it with a friend. In 3, 2, 1, the mic is going. It's another episode of Sacktown Talks. This week I'm pleased to introduce Dan Moraine. How are you, brother?
Great.
Thanks for coming in. You know, you it's not an easy thing to do to battle traffic coming into South Sac in the morning before work. So thank you. I was hoping that we could just kind of continue to reflect on this conversation that we're having. Everyone's a publisher now.
That's right. Everyone is a publisher. Everyone can be a publisher. You know, it's so different from when I started in the news business. You know, I got out of college in 76 and you know, it was newspapers and broadcast television and radio, and that was it. And you really did need to be own the printing press in order to get your word out. Now you can do it via Twitter.
Yeah, you can do it via Twitter.
For good or ill.
For good or for bad. Yeah. Just a little bit of background on you. You're the newest hire at CalMatters.
Well, actually, I'm not the newest hire at CalMatters. There have been two hires since me. It's a growing organization.
When did you come into CalMatters?
Well, I left the Sacramento Bee at the last day of February, and I took a long weekend, 2 days, and started on Monday.
Okay.
First Monday in March.
So I think there's a lot to unpack there. I kind of want to get back to our conversation about the changing nature of publishing. You've gone to a nonprofit journalistic venture. I'd like to touch on that. I guess just by way of introduction for you, you were at the Modesto Bee for a little bit.
No, never at the Modesto Bee.
You weren't?
No. I was at the Sacramento Bee. I came to the Bee in 2010. And I started as a columnist and editorial writer and became editorial page editor.
Sorry, and before that, you were at the LA Times.
Before that, I was at the LA Times. And in between there, I took a few months and worked in PR for a little while.
Yeah, about 9 months for the consumer attorneys. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was a quick turnaround.
You know, it was time to leave the LA Times. I've been there 27 years and had a great run. Loved almost every minute at the LA Times, except for the last few minutes. Got a chance to cover the 2018 or the 2008 presidential election, and it was a great team that we had set up there to do it. And mm-hmm. It was time to move on. And then it was, you know, I was quite fortunate, I think, to get hired at the Bee. I had a great time there. But this is a new thing, and I'm looking forward to it.
Did you know Aurelio Rojas in your time over at?
I did, sure, of course.
I had the pleasure.
He's a character. He's a wild man. He's got stories to tell about everybody.
About everybody, man. Don't get him going on Richie Ross.
Or Antonio Villaraigosa, who would be governor. You know, he went to school with him down in L.A. He's a reporter for the Sacramento Bee for a lot of years. And then at the end of his career, he went to work in the Capitol in the building.
Jerry Hill. That's where I
Jerry Hill. Him. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, no, he's a great guy.
I just wanted to reflect on him a little bit. So I think that's his real passion or his real talent is storytelling.
Oh, what a storyteller.
You know, I got to bring Aurelio, if you're out there and you're listening, I doubt you are, but you got to come on. Hey, so just quickly, one of the places that we see folks sort of hop ship to in the decline of the newspaper era is sort of like this like in-house communications gig, sort of, you know, maybe working for the consumer attorneys, putting the spin on their stuff, working for an elected official, putting the spin on their stuff. You did that for about 9 months.
Yeah, maybe, thereabouts.
Yeah. Not for you, maybe kind of like, do you?
It was a great job. I love those guys. You know, it was a great place to be, but you know, really, you know, some of us have a little bit of ink in our veins you know, so when the opportunity came up to, you know, get back in the business, I took it.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was just wondering sort of like, is there like a, just how different are those lines of work and sort of like if you're.
Well, it's similar, but, You know, it's a similar sort of skill set, but you know, my wife was a newspaper reporter for a lot of years, and then went into public relations, worked for UC Davis and University of the Pacific as their news service director, and she was really good at it. But a lot of us, it's a different skill set to be a to do PR versus news business. It's just, you know, it's not everybody can do it, and and she did. I maybe was not quite as good at
it. I'll almost offer it's kind of the opposite, right? Like you're trying to encourage people not to be objective and be like, hey, you know, everything I'm putting out is the best thing since sliced bread. I mean,
yeah, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, the trial lawyers are a little bit different. They're a different breed because, you know, they're you know, in some sense, gunslingers. They're you know, very independent guys and women.
Yeah.
A tough breed.
They are. They are. My, you know, buddy of mine's a trial lawyer.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And he says everyone kind of gives them, you know, like kind of not really gives them shit, but, you know, no one really appreciates one until they need one, right?
That's right.
And then he's your hero. That's right.
You never want to have to hire a lawyer. I've got a daughter who's a lawyer. So and you know, I covered courts for a lot of years. I have great respect for what lawyers do on both sides. You know, if they're defense lawyers or plaintiff's lawyers, you know, it's a fundamental right in the United States to have access to the courts. And, you know, that's something that sets us apart.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to talk about is sort of the, you know, in the building when I worked for, you know, our mugs, Tony Atkins, right. As you see your elected official term out, right? Mm-hmm. You got to jump ship. You got to find either the next one to work for, maybe go work for the consumer attorneys or another interest group. But, you know, you kind of see the edge of the cliff there, and you got to, you know.
Or you set up a multimedia empire like you set up here.
This is going to be a while before it really monetizes, I think. But for right now, it's just for, you know, it's fun. Is the SACB termed out?
No. I think, so, you know, when I got into the business, it was very, very different. So this is 76, right? That's when I got out of college. I think that's the year. And I started working for a very small paper in Madera, the smallest daily circulation paper in California. And I was there for 3 months. And then I went down to a little paper in Oceanside and was there for 8 months. And then worked for a paper up in Washington State for, I don't know, 18 months or so, and then moved down to LA, got a job at the LA Herald Examiner, so which is termed out. So many of these papers that I worked for were termed out. I mean, the Herald Examiner was, you know, I think it at one time was the biggest circulation paper in America, right? And it died. The Madera Tribune, I think, is still around. The Oceanside Blade Tribune is not.
Yeah.
The first paper I worked for in college was a little weekly. It's not. So, you know, papers change, and it's been kind of the nature of the business that you know, there's been consolidation. But I think there's an evolution going on. I don't know how it's going to end up. But, you know, again, when I started, there was no CNN, there was no Fox, there was no MSNBC. The New York Times was a regional paper. When I worked at the LA Times, for a while, it was the largest circulation paper in the country. It was 1.5 million people would read it or would get it. And but it was all in Southern California. Today, when you write a story, I mean, you can hear from people in Australia. I've got correspondence going on with people in Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, anybody who speaks English can have access to what we write. So the reach is much greater. But as you alluded to, how to make money off it is another question. So I think there's an evolution going on. I don't count the Sacramento Bee out. It's paper been around for 160 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's changing.
Yeah. You know? Is that how does CalMatters fit into that mold where, you know, you're changing sort of, hey, this is a nonprofit journalistic venture.
Right.
Instead of a way to make money, this is something that is intrinsically good. Is that?
Well, you know, when I came to the LA Times Bureau in Sacramento, there were 14 people. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Today, I think it's number Melanie six Mason? Or some okay. six or seven, something like that. The B, I'm sure, was a dozen people at the time, and they're down. But you know, the LA Times and Sacramento Bee still are committed to covering the Capitol. You know, the Chronicle used to have four or five people in the bureau. Yeah. They've got one. The Merck, which, you know, had a really aggressive bureau for a few years, has one person here, you know, for the Bay Area News Group. So there's a, you know, back in 2007, I think it was, I counted up the number of just print reporters, people who worked for print publications who were around in at the start of the Schwarzenegger administration. So this would have been 2004. And there were about 75.
Okay.
And then in 2007, I counted, and there were half that number.
Oh, my God.
And you know, I don't know, are there 20 full-time print reporters in Sacramento, covering Sacramento? Now, it's not because Sacramento is less of a story. It's a huge story.
Yeah.
You know, it's a $180 billion budget. You know, what happens in Sacramento affects so much as it relates to the environment, and you know, there are all these legislative efforts that to regulate huge businesses. I mean, there's a bill up, you know, to create net neutrality in California.
Price controls on medicine.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, so we're doing all kinds of interesting things in the state, but there are fewer and fewer reporters to cover it, and so that's the niche that CalMatters seeks to fill. We're not going to cover Donald Trump. We're not going to cover the Modesto City Council, but we're going to cover what happens, what's relevant in the Capitol. So, you know, housing policy. We have a reporter devoted to covering housing. We have a higher ed reporter. It used to be there were, you know, basically any paper that had a college in its town would have somebody covering higher ed.
Yeah.
Not so much anymore. And we have somebody covering K-12 policy on a statewide basis. And so our niche is to cover California because we believe that the policy and politics of California matter. And what we produce is free to any publication or radio station or a television station that wants to use it, right? I mean, that's what, and it's funded by, you know, I mean, I don't know them all. I know a few of them, you know, big donors who, yeah, you know, sort of care about the cause, right?
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea.
No. Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's right. kind of absolutely necessary in today's era, yeah, right?
I hope so.
You know, just to expand on what you were talking about there about the reach, my someone in Oman downloaded the podcast.
Really? Yeah.
Someone in Oman. And yeah. So the martial arts podcast that I run,
yeah,
is in, you know, 38 countries now.
Very cool.
Yeah. So cool. there's folks in Turkey. Actually, one of the guys that I brought on was good friends with like a Turkish like prince, or, you know, he's sort of connected in, you, yeah, know, in the high levels of government in Turkey, yeah, about 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So I said, hey, why don't you come out here and start the first jiu-jitsu school in Turkey? So my buddy Cassio was like, okay, I guess, you know. So he spent 2 years in Turkey just being treated like a king, you know, because he was the only black belt in Turkey. So when I had Cassio on, you know, I could just see that blip, all those folks in Turkey.
Yeah.
All those folks, yeah, in Turkey, you know, that, you know, he's produced 40 black belts,
uh-huh,
in his martial arts career. And just for perspective for you, a jiu-jitsu black belt's a 10-year endeavor.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like a PhD.
Very cool.
And so he produced two in Turkey. And those two own different schools. So they're kind of like the family history tree, like,
right,
like the pedigree kind of goes like that, right? There's folks in Italy, you know, downloading, yeah, the podcast.
Yeah.
And then the number two market for me, for the martial arts podcast is Japan.
Hmm.
And
makes sense.
Yeah. And I would just want to say I would forego monetary riches to just be a cultural icon in Japan. Just as a thing, yeah, to do, I think being, yeah, big in Japan would be like totally cool, you know.
Yeah.
So you've been at it for close to 40 years.
Well, more than 40 years.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of years. Yeah, I left it. Well, I mean, my first job, you know, finishing up in college was in 76, right? As a news person, right?
Yeah.
But so 42 years.
I'm
old.
Yeah. up and down the state of California, a little bit in Washington, but focusing on California politics and policy.
Yes.
What's the craziest thing you've seen?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I mean, some of the big stories that you know, I mean, to witness an execution, you never forget that.
You witnessed one?
Yeah. The first one after 20 years, 1992, the execution of Robert Alton Harris. And that was a huge story because it was the first after the death penalty was reinstated in California.
Got it.
And then it was a gas chamber execution, and so there was a big fight over whether that was a constitutional, whether that was cruel and unusual punishment. Certainly was unusual. And then, you know, as he was in the as he was strapped down in the death chamber, phone rang, and you know, you don't expect to hear a telephone ring, in that situation, you know, it's you know, where we were standing, where the witnesses were standing is dark, and the gas chamber is lit. And, you know, there's this guy sitting in the chair, strapped down, can't move. And you expect that, okay, you know, here it comes, but then the phone rings and it was, Judge Harry Pregerson, calling, the warden to stop the execution. This was after midnight. The anniversary is coming up. I think it was the 22nd of April when he was executed.
What happened?
Well, he put a stay on it, and so, you know, Harris is sitting there, and you could see him mouth words. I thought the words were, you know, like let's do it or let's get it over, whatever it is. But they had to come in. The guards had to come in and unstrap them, and it went on. You know, it went bounced up and down to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was you know, it was quite a scene. And then finally, the Supreme Court took it out of the hands of the California judges, the California federal judges. And basically just said, "No, this guy's number's up.
It's time to go."
And so they ended up executing him about dawn that morning.
So quick process.
Well, it was 6 hours, but it had been going on for decades. I mean, the murders he committed were in, you know, the '70s, right? Yeah. So it was a very long process, actually.
No, I just meant from getting the call and then to finally going through with it.
Yeah.
So you stuck around for those 6 hours there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it was a historic. It was historic. It was macabre. But it was historic. And then afterward, you know, Harry Pregerson, who was a giant on the bench in Los Angeles, I had known him from my days working in L.A., covering a big trial in his courtroom. I talked to him afterward, and he told me the story of why he did it. And it's, you know, it's kind of funny. He called the San Quentin prison and asked, somebody answered the phone and asked who he was, and he said Harry Pregerson, and whoever answered the phone had no idea who he was. And he said, well, I'm a judge on the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and whoever it was had no idea who he was.
Yeah.
And so so it took him a while and some sort of calm talking to get to the warden, and he finally got to the warden. And then later, I talked to the warden, Dan Vasquez, who was really an interesting man.
How so?
Well, just, you know, I mean, he was a tough, tough guy, worked his way up.
I'll bet that'll make you a tough guy over time. Yeah,
worked his way up from a prison guard to become warden of San Quentin. And in that role, it was his job to, you know, pull the lever, whatever it was, to drop the pellets that would have that ultimately killed Harris. But I talked to him afterward and I said, so how close were you? And he said, oh, I was right there. You know, I was very close, right? So, I mean, had that phone not rung, you know, 4 or 5 seconds later would have been too late. Anyway, you know, so that was certainly a huge story. You know, I covered a lot of big stories. I mean, I met my wife covering the eruption of Mount St. Helens up in Washington State. She was a reporter for a paper in suburban Washington, and I was up there. I had just moved down to LA and was working for the LA Herald Examiner. I was up there visiting, and I was in Seattle, and it, one thing led to another. It's a long story, but she and I ended up driving from Seattle down to as close as you could get to the mountain.
Yeah.
You don't want to get too close to an eruption.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so that's how, you know,
that's how you two met.
That's how we met. So that was a big story, the biggest story.
I'll bet.
The ongoing story. And then, you know, I was in San Francisco for the Loma Prieta earthquake. I was working on 1989, and I was working on a story, a little scandal involving, at least I thought it was a scandal involving the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And it was, you know, just before 5 o'clock on whatever day of the week it was. And I had to run over to the federal courthouse to get some documents. And I hit the elevator button, and you know, I knew the place was going to close at 5 o'clock. And so it was a few minutes before five. And I, God damn it. You know, elevator's not coming. And it, as it happens, there was a system in the building set up that when the pre-shocks come, the pre-shock waves come, that the elevator shut down, right? So I didn't realize that. I was swearing at the elevator and it never came. Which is good because you know, I could hear the big rumble coming and then the big shake. And it was a really big damn earthquake.
Yeah.
And, you know, spent the whole night and on into the next morning, you know, basically reporting the hell out of that story.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was so surreal. I mean, somebody said, you know, the World Series was going on, the A's versus the Giants, and it was at Candlestick Park. So, of course, they shut down that game. But as the evening wore on, somebody said, you know, the Bay Bridge collapsed. No way, that could never happen. But sure enough, there was a big hole in the Bay Bridge. There were houses in the Marina District of San Francisco that were literally lifted up off their foundation and deposited in the middle of the streets. And, you know, fires all over. And, you know, I mean, there was a big brick building that fell down on people, and you know, which I saw. And that was, you know, so, I mean, you could tell that this was a big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was.
Kind of macabre also, kind of.
Hmm?
Just kind of gruesome also.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, that, and then, you know, all kinds of crazy crimes. And
political stuff too. You
know, political stuff.
Recall of Gray Davis. I remember I was a kid for that one.
Yeah.
I just remember, for some reason, that sticks out in my mind because I feel like Cruz Bustamante ran the most tortured campaign. You know, like, I don't want to be governor, but if you have to, you should vote for me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and then he did not equip himself well in that. It's unfortunate. You know, it was, you know, Gray Davis, once the recall qualified, really never had much of a chance. I mean, he was not he had become very unpopular. And, you know, he almost lost the re-election in 2002, and probably would have lost it if the then mayor of L.A., Dick Reardon, had won the nomination. I think Reardon would have beaten Davis. Anyway, he squeaked by this guy, Bill Simon, who was not a very good candidate, Republican. And then, you know, Daryl Issa, the congressman from San Diego County, put up the money to get the signatures to recall him, and that was that. So
yeah,
hell of a story.
Yeah, yeah. It was just one of the first things that sort of piqued my interest in politics. Is just the narrative of it seemed so twisted, you know.
Yeah, it was.
Let me go back to the death penalty thing, because I've not I frankly, I didn't know the story. I'm embarrassed to say, you know.
That was a long time
ago. It's a long time ago, yeah. Should we be in the business of killing people?
Well, so I'm not... let me see how to answer that. I'm not a moral... I'm not an absolutist on the death penalty. But it doesn't work. You know, it just... Yeah. It doesn't work. It
takes decades.
And you know, you have more than 750 people on death row. You know, there are people on death row today whose trial was going on when I worked in LA from 79 to 84. And you know, they grow. Far more people are dying there of old age than will ever be executed. Anyway, it doesn't work. So I think as society is so conflicted over it. Now, you know, it may come to pass that the law that was passed in 2016 by voters to theoretically speed up the death penalty will in fact speed up the death penalty, and then people will have to decide. You know, I've never been an absolutist. But then I've gotten to know people on death row and you know, and having witnessed one, I'm pretty, I'm not sure it's something we as a government, as a state, as a people ought to be in the business of. But
okay. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I think I'm kind of with you there too. I mean, I feel like if we're going to do it, we ought to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're going to do it, it should take decades. The problem with it taking decades is that oftentimes you're going to be executing a different person. You know, a reformed person.
Yeah, the person who is, you know, tweaked on meth, who, you know, goes on some crazy spree is not the same person 20 years later. Yeah. It's just not.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. One of the latest things that you're covering, I mean, two big things this year is, the Me Too movement and, of course, the governor's race. I'd just like to sort of open up and get your candid thoughts on both. I think...
Well, I'm a bit player in Me Too. In the coverage of it. The governor's race, I think the governor's race is just fascinating. You know, we've got a Jerry Brown has been unique. Nobody will ever repeat what he's done with four terms as governor. I think he's done an admirable job in so many different ways. You know, he came into the state with a huge budget deficit. He's leaving with a huge budget surplus. You know, no thanks to some of the taxes that he helped raise. Nonetheless, it's a stable budget. There are huge, big problems he's leaving. One is what to do, and ones that he acknowledges, what to do about public employee pension debt. I mean, that's a huge issue.
Yeah.
Not that people should not get a pension. People who work ought to be able to retire in dignity. But then if you promise somebody a pension, you got to pay for it. Well, right. You know, there's a big pension gap alive, and California has to figure out how to fill that, and cities need to figure out how to fill it. It's a big problem. Homelessness is a huge problem, and it was a big problem before he came into office, and it's worse now. And so the next governor is going to have to deal with that. You know, what are we going to do about our water infrastructure? I mean, it's a huge, big issue. Like, you know, he's been very supportive, driving force behind re-engineering the Delta to, you know, put in these two 40-foot tunnels, 30 miles, 150 feet underground. I mean, that's a huge, big project.
Huge project, yeah.
And he's pushing for it, and he's got some support and a lot of opposition. But the next governor is going to inherit that. The next governor is going to inherit high-speed rail. So we have, you know, what to do with it. You know, it's clearly far more than the people agreed to spend. Technology's changing. I mean, but at the same time, you know, things are getting built, right? I mean, they're building it in Fresno and in the Central Valley, and it's a huge big job creator down there, and that's a big deal. So anyway, so the next governor is going to have all kinds of tough issues to confront. And who's it going to be? It's going to be decided in June. Well, could be decided in June. If a Republican
makes it into
the top two, then whoever the top one is, and it's most likely going to be Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, will be the next governor, because a Republican can't win a statewide office in California unless you're Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? So it's just, you know, John Cox or Travis Allen, the two leading Republicans, they're not going to be Gavin Newsom. Yeah. I mean, I just can't imagine it unless something extraordinary happens. Now, just yesterday, there was another $1 million dropped into a campaign account, independent campaign account, to boost Antonio Villaraigosa, the former LA mayor, former assembly speaker. And so there's now been $9.5 million put into this independent campaign to boost his effort. Well, you know, $9.5 million speaks pretty loudly.
Yeah.
donated by three people. One is Netflix founder Reed Hastings. One is LA billionaire Eli Broad. And the other is by former LA mayor Dick Reardon. So they're going to spend that money. That money is going to be spent to boost Villaraigosa and rip the bark off John Cox or Travis Allen, whoever seems to be closest to, you know, gaining that top two slot. It's something to behold. Now, it's conceivable that there will be a big independent expenditure to boost John Chung, the treasurer. Don't see that happening, but it's possible.
He's been sort of kind of...
He's laying in the weeds.
Yeah.
And, not raising a lot of money into his own account. We'll see. I'm sure he's got friends who could create an independent expenditure on his behalf. I haven't seen it materialize. So it all gets played out in these independent campaigns. I mean, Villaraigosa's been running since 2016, raising money since 2016. He's raised, you know, not $9.5 million. Well, $9.5 million in the last week has flowed into this one independent expenditure. So all that effort he's put in,
it gets
overtaken by millionaires and billionaires.
Yeah, easily. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's just got to make it. He's just got to make it. Through June.
He's got to get on the ballot in June, and then it will be a real dogfight.
That's a real fight. That'll be a real fight.
Yeah. So, I wouldn't bet on the outcome.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Once you get there, it's kind of like
it's kind of like
the fifth round of a tough fight. It's kind of this could go either way, you know. You said something interesting that I thought I kind of wanted to invite you to reflect on. You know, a Republican can't win statewide office here in California. You've kind of seen that change, right? I mean, you've lived through the Ronald Reagan era. You've lived through the...
Well, I was a baby.
You're a baby in the Ronald Reagan era. Yeah, yeah. But
certainly George Dignation.
Pete Wilson.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you've been around for an era where the legislature didn't have a super minority of Republicans, right? You've seen sort of like the Assembly Democratic Caucus, the Senate Democratic Caucus, sort of really gel and coalesce a 2/3 majority, right? What has that done to the governance of our state? What is a Democrat holding every office up and down the roster done for our state? Is it a good thing?
So I don't think one party rule is a very good idea.
Okay.
But Republicans have sort of made their bed. And Pete Wilson, I was here for almost all of Pete Wilson's tenure. I think he was a very good governor in a lot of ways. And he made a big mistake by wrapping himself around Prop 187. This was the initiative back in 1994 that sought to cut off any public funding for illegal immigrants, including kids who were in public schools and you know, theoretically old people in nursing homes, right? I mean, right. nobody would do that. Anyway, so this was a nasty initiative. It energized a lot of Mexican Americans, a lot of immigrants.
It turned out all the wrong people for
them. And it passed. And you know, this would have helped theoretically Pete Wilson in his run for president in 1996. Well, that didn't turn out so well, but he needed something to sort of shore up his conservative credentials, and that was one, I think. And it also certainly helped him win re-election in 1994, but it turned a generation of young voters against the Republican Party. Donald Trump's turning a generation of young voters against the Republican Party. In my little newsletter, What Matters, to which you can subscribe for free by going to CalMatters, I wrote this morning about the first 100,000 pre-registered high school kids. So these are 17-year-old kids who can pre-register to vote. Well, Democrats are outnumbering Republicans 4-1 there, right? So yeah. 38,000 Democrats to 10,000 Republican pre-registrants. You know, I think that's an impact of Donald Trump, and some of the stands that too many Republicans have taken. They're not talking to young people in a way that they're being heard, or maybe they are being heard, and people who are 16 and 17 just don't see the point.
Yeah.
Of registering a Republican. You know, that said, decline to states are a greater number than Democrats. So young people are turning against party labels. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think so too.
excuse me.
Bless you. Mm. I think it's an interesting thing. You were talking about, you know, Prop 187. Just yesterday, I think we saw a poll. You know, not a lot of love on these immigrant these immigration initiatives. You know, the California Values Act. Mm-hmm. What did the poll say? Something like 54% of Californians, you know, don't love SB 54.
No, I'm sure.
And I'll just say this for me, you know, as an immigrant myself, I kind of get a little bit dismayed at how the public policy universe around what we do for immigrants in California is so focused on criminal immigrants. Mm-hmm. It's so focused on, you know, keeping the folks who have had run-ins with the law in this country.
Right.
I never got in trouble. My mother,
of course,
my mother never got in trouble. My sister never got in trouble. There's a whole slew of us that came here, you know, got to work on time, did, you know, went to school, and the fixation on helping criminal immigrants. I can tell you, I don't see criminal immigrants as part of my community.
Right.
You know.
Right. Well,
you can let them go for all I care. No, I get that. It's especially if you're an immigrant with darker skin, you're more likely to be profiled. You're more likely to have run-ins with the law. Especially, I had a relatively privileged background. I mean, by which I mean I had a roof over my head, and I didn't. Right. You know, we had food at the dinner table. So I get that there's things that kept me out of the criminal justice system, you know, a caring and involved mother, but the fixation on helping criminal immigrants, you know, in the public policy universe is, you know, I think to me is misplaced, and I think
of course it is. It's, you know, it's crazy. It's, you know, I mean, I hesitate to say racist, but you know, if it fits. You know, one of the things that they say in politics is to attack if you're attacking your opponent, you go after his strength, not his weakness, or her weakness. And you know, if you're a really hardworking person, well, maybe that's where you attack that person. You say, well, you're not working hard. You're a criminal. I don't know. Just to me, it's crazy. I mean, I don't know any slackers who are immigrants.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never met one.
It's not why they came here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So you come here to grab a part of the California dream or the American dream. You don't come here to get on welfare and to mug people. I mean, obviously there are people who do that. I don't know, a lot of native born people who've done that.
Do that too. In fact, right. More likely to do that.
But you know, it goes on forever. I mean, a couple years ago, I had spent a great day on Ellis Island in New York. And if you've never been there, you should go make that pilgrimage. And it really is like a pilgrimage. I mean, you know, you can see the big hall where, you know, my grandfather and grandmother came through. And you can look them up in the computers there that show, you know, what Bodie came over on.
Oh my goodness.
And you know, as a kid, you know, with a bunch of other kids from his small little town in Italy. You know, so we've all come here that way, except for, you know, Native Americans. We've all come here. And you know, you look back at what was going on in the early 1900s and you know, 1920s. It's a continuation.
Yeah.
I mean, go back and read some of the magazines about, you know, these swarthy Italians who were coming over to mug you with, you know, with knives and, you know, big mustaches. And I mean, just the caricatures were stunning.
Right.
And it's the same thing. It's the same garbage.
Yeah. You know, I was having a beer over at Sacktown Union. They're just up the
nice.
Street. Great beer. Good little ambiance too. They're like dog and kid friendly in the front, but in the back it's adults only.
Right.
I actually really enjoy that. Posted up at the bar was this sort of like this kind of old Italian gentleman. His wife was running a fundraiser for their middle school, you know, for the parents in the front room. So, you know, they had parents and dogs in the front. He's just kind of hanging back in the back. So we get to talking and, you know, he's just very engaged with me. You know, he bought my wife and I beers and we start talking. I don't know why we start talking movies, you know. I tell him, well, you know, one of my favorite movies is Goodfellas, The Godfather. And he just says to me very sternly, I hate that shit. I don't like that stuff at all. You know, and he's like, let me tell you something. We came here to work, you know, and exactly what you were talking about. Like, you know, for me, I just think, and then, you know, after a little bit of cajoling, he kind of protested, okay, they were fine movies. But, you know, kind of like that sort of reputation. And like, my goodness, I thought, it sounded just like a Mexican could have been having that conversation with us. Like, you know, I hate that characterization, you know. Now we just kind of look at it as like a joke, but I'm sure back in the day, that's a very serious problem.
Yeah,
you know, you're characterizing us all as criminals.
Yep.
We should wrap this thing up. We both got to get going here. One final note to end on. Sort of, I just wanted you to reflect on sort of like the rise of fake news and how does that make what you do more important? You know, did you ever think we'd get here where we are? You know, the president made something like 1,950 false claims last year.
Yeah, well, right? I mean, but who's counting? You know,
are we in a post-truth era?
Well, no, truth still matters. I mean, you know, in my newsletter today, I ran a little correction, right? I mean, if you get it wrong, you got to correct it, right? You try to get it right every day. And you know, I don't know how many bylines I have over 42 years, you know, 5,000 maybe. I mean, a lot. And, you know, you're going to get wrong certain things and you correct it. But there's a big difference between that and fake news. You know, I've never made something up. There have been people who call themselves journalists who do make it up, and you know, they get drummed out. I mean, you know, people like Janet Cook or Stephen Glass. I mean, there are people who make stuff up and they get drummed out. I wish some of the pundits on national cable shows who make stuff up would get drummed out. And they will at some point. You know, some point there will be a reckoning, I believe. You know, what President Trump is doing is dangerous. You know, it is a fragile thing we have, this democracy, and we've learned that in the last few years. And for him to, you know, cavalierly, you know, accuse the New York Times of making stuff up, it's bad. And you know, I do hear it. I mean, I do hear it from people who, you know, maybe they're joking, maybe they're not, talk about fake news. You know.
Yeah, I mean,
the only thing I think that we can do as journalists or podcasters is to do what we do, right?
Yeah.
And you know, the answer to wrong speech is more speech, whatever that line is, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, I just think we kind of do what we do, and you know, I do believe our work speaks for itself, and you know, maybe people who accuse us of being dishonorable and dishonest, you know, as part of their shtick, which is what it is, it's all shtick.
Yeah,
he didn't believe it.
No.
You know, maybe they'll face a reckoning at some point too.
Yeah,
maybe not.
I'll offer this. I think fake news has been around for a little bit longer than we've really recognized it, and it's just sort of had different names and faces. My mom follows a Mexican home remedy blog.
Ah,
you know, you have a toothache, smoke a cigarette. You know, kind of wrapped up in the culture of shamanistic superstition and you know, in rural Mexico, right? Which is interesting because just quickly, like, Mexico didn't wipe out its native population the way that America did. So the Catholicism over there is wrapped in with, like, a lot of the native superstition, you know? But she follows this, you know, home remedy blog. And I was like, Mom, I think this might be fake news, Mom. I don't think a lot of these home remedies work. You know, and then among the martial artists and the fighters that I work out with, they have this thing called a VO2 mask. It's the dumbest thing in the world, but everyone wears it. It's this mask that you wear. It's like a snorkel. And it's supposed to train your lungs to pull air harder and deeper into your lungs.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to train you to work on less air as well. Also, the mask makes you look kind of menacing when you train. I think that's why people like it. It doesn't work. By all accounts, it doesn't work. But everyone, sure enough, everyone's got one, you know. And they cite these, like, blogs about how it helped me. It's like, wait a second. I think you guys are citing fake news, you know. So I think there's sort of like a nucleus of beliefs that we kind of want to hold on to.
Yeah.
And then something kind of comes and attaches to that. And before you know it, you're kind of down this pathway, you know. So we rely on the good work of people like you to sort of steer us in the right direction.
Yeah, well, you're right. Snake oil has been around forever.
Yeah,
and people buy it, and they believe and they wish and they hope that there's some magic cure to whatever it is, whatever ails you, whatever's wrong in your life. You know, some politician will come along and say, "I'll fix that, by God."
Yeah, yeah.
We'll see.
Dan Matters with Cal Matters' daily newsletter is What Matters.
All right.
Dan Moraine with Cal Matters. I'm sorry, brother. Make sure to subscribe to his daily newsletter, What Matters.
Good, great.
Thanks for coming on,
brother. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
So much fun.
Appreciate you.
All right.